You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Zimbabwe has a new president, which is a far from common occurrence. But how much hope should Zimbabweans or anyone place in a new leader? My guests Tom Edwards, Henry Rees-Sheridan and Gaia Lutz will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the UK's distinctly sub-Houdini efforts to extricate itself from the EU, whether or not slightly cheaper rail travel will change the political outlook of an entire generation, and the Brazilian prison, which is more like a parliament. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Tom Edwards, Gaia Lutz, and Henry Rees-Sheridan. Welcome all. It is 37 years since anybody was last able to use the phrase the new president of Zimbabwe. As of a ceremony today at the National Sports Stadium in Zimbabwe, it applies to Emmerson Mnangagwa, the former vice president who has succeeded his former boss, Robert Mugabe. President Mnangagwa faces the daunting tasks of rebuilding Zimbabwe, in the ruination of which he was complicit, and of answering the hope and meeting the expectations of Zimbabweans, who are likely, with good reason, to regard almost anything as an improvement. I am aware, of course, that there have technically been other presidents of Zimbabwe, but I was making a rhetorical point about Robert Mugabe's domination of the country. Henry, first of all, how much patience specifically is Emmerson and Mnangagwa entitled to?
I think it depends from what perspective you come at that question. One way to look at it is that if I assumed a role from someone who had that role for 37 years, I would personally want a considerable amount of patience. On the other hand, considering the state of the country which he now presides over, I wouldn't blame normal Zimbabweans for not having a huge amount of patience for him to get stuff fixed, or at least to begin to improve things fairly immediately, although, of course, that's a very difficult task.
Tom Edwards, in general, I want to broaden this discussion out a bit into leaders as a thing. When there is a new leader, is it necessarily smart for people to get hopeful about it?
Well, listen, Andrew, I think it's very difficult to address that. I know you're saying let's widen it out, but in the case of Zimbabwe, it's critical to remember the background and some of the baggage that Mnangagwa brings to the table. This is a guy who was sort of had the finger pointed at him by the United Nations, 10-15 years ago, as being, you know, one of the corruptors in chief. He's the richest man in the country. Much of that allegedly is ill-gotten gain from various sort of malfeasance. However, he does have a political track record of delivering. He's supposed to be a very capable politician, as would befit a man who is very charming and very effective at self-promotion and all the rest. Clearly, it's going to be incredibly complex to try and move the process forward. And in Zimbabwe, and what is perhaps different to other similar circumstances where an established leader goes, is that, you know, he talked almost reverentially about Mugabe. He congratulated him on many of his achievements, some of which are legitimate. And there isn't that feeling of like a letting of blood. But that could hinder Zimbabwe. You know, the idea is that they should have free and fair elections as early as next year, but they're not having that big cathartic moment. I mean, we did have effectively a coup, but it didn't have that quality that we often expect of cleansing when you get rid of despotic or, you know, autocratic leaders. And then how that speaks to the bigger picture, I think that's a problem in this case. And I think it lacks similarities with some other cases where you've had someone who's ruled for many decades, because you don't have that feeling of galvanizing a whole population, of mass momentum, of mass participation. You know, this guy has all these links to ZANU-PF and all the other problems that they have. it's going to be very hard to see that kind of seismic political shift happening here.
Gaia, you come from a country, i.e. Brazil, whose political peculiarities we will be discussing further later in the show, but you've had quite a run now of national leaders whose careers or terms have ended in a certain amount of ignominy. Do people still get hopeful after a certain run of that? Is it possible to imagine another figure appearing on Brazil's political scene that makes people think, yes, hooray, at last?
I think yes, but in a scary way. I think people get more hopeful for the populist characters, for the Trump-like characters that offer simple solutions to the problems. But going back to what Tom was saying about this big cathartic moment, you know, the climax of all this havoc in Brazil was when Dilma was impeached. And even though, you know, Temer had been accused, I mean, you know, he had 9% of approval basically all the way through the moment he got in the presidency until now. Even though that's the case, I can still understand why people were hopeful when he got into power. I want to excuse myself and say I wasn't one of those people. But I can understand that, you know, when a situation is so landlocked, you know, locked, it hasn't moved, it doesn't seem to be going anywhere for so long, that any new situation brings some sort of hope, even if it's not hope that the new person in itself will change the country, but that it will move something or shift something and make, you know, perhaps the following person to be, you know, something they've awaited for.
I think that's a very astute point, but I think one of the problems implicit with that is that it's the hope that destroys. And we've seen it even in the Western European countries where we got, in inverted commas, the result we wanted, Macron being successful, not having populists returned in the Netherlands or wherever else. And it delivers a tide of public opinion and enthusiasm that then raises expectations. And it makes people forget, we know politically people have short memories, how bad the problems are. Macron, we've seen battles with this. It's very difficult for him to function effectively, as polished a political operator as he is. And yet, because there was this groundswell, oh, it's not the two old parties. He's young and dynamic. He has said he's going to tear up the rulebook. Then that you get it your first day, as it were, with your feet under the desk, and you're confronted with the reality that it's very difficult to actually deliver on those kind of aspirations.
I mean, the politician, I think, of our time, who obviously made the most of the idea of running on hope, was President Barack Obama. And I was in Philadelphia on election night in 2008, which was an excellent evening to be in Philadelphia, that the hope thing did seem quite tangible. It was something people took very seriously, and I suspect he probably did himself. But Henry, if you run on that, are you not just setting yourself up to fail, wouldn't it be better if Barack Obama had run on a platform of, look, you know, I'll do my best?
I think that you are destined to fail if you inspire any hope in almost any field of human endeavour. And I think that lowering expectations is always good.
And listeners, I can attest that Henry delivers on this by consistently disappointing in his professional career.
I practice what I preach.
Have you ever thought of setting up a political consultancy? I would invest heavily.
Caution in Inc.
Exactly. Lowered expectations.
Hit rock bottom. Join me.
I do think that the expectations of electorates as a whole, there are interesting analogies you can draw with, you know, individual expectations. It's remarkable that if you look at the kind of consistently rising living standards over the last, say, 100 years in at least the Western world, and, you know, we're living through a moment now where actually that historical tide may be turning, but you can't identify, at least I can't identify, a point where people are broadly content with the political status quo. You know, I think that to a certain degree, democracy itself breeds discontent because, first of all, the system always incentivizes people popping up and telling people that they're discontent. But also, expectations about what can be achieved are essentially limitless in theory.
I just think there's an interesting point here, and I think politicians are now starting to kind of game the idea of hope and aspiration politically. I guess they've always done it to a sense. But even if you look at someone like Jeremy Corbyn in this country, I think he likes to push and buy into this idea that he's the alternate and the change candidate and invest your hope for a new and different future in me. And it actually means that you can you shift the parameters for what people's expectations are in terms of political delivery. you basically absolve yourself of the responsibility of having to do anything because you say, no, don't get bogged down in detail. All you need to do is dream. It's an easy way out.
Well, on a related subject, let us now consider the latest frictionless progress of Brexit. Theresa May, who is still Prime Minister of the United Kingdom for some reason, is visiting a security summit in Brussels, where she met with Angela Merkel, who remains Chancellor of Germany as of this broadcast. May has been told that she has until the beginning of December, and that's this December, which is, let's see, soonish, to furnish more acceptable answers on the so-called divorce bill and the Irish border, which means that May has a week, give or take, to find an extra several billion quid and a solution to an impossible diplomatic quandary. And there was me feeling sorry for myself because I've got 1,600 words to write by Monday. Henry, I've run some numbers here. Apparently, the UK government is willing to come up with 40 billion quid. Now, 350 million a week, which we're going to save, that's only 11 weeks. Do you think they can pitch that to Leave voters?
I don't feel very in touch. Let me correct myself. I feel even less in touch now with the psychology of the Leave voter than I did previously. I actually haven't spoken to one personally about how they feel the process is going now.
That's because you're an elitist metropolitan snob, Henry.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, anytime.
Has anyone here spoken to someone about that? Because I would be interested in hearing about that. I just don't know where the Brexiteer debate is at the moment.
Are you asking us if we've gone out and interacted with members of the general public?
I don't know what you do in your spare time, Andrew.
Safe to assume, not that, Andrew.
No, but the Irish border, Tom, I will put to you. Have you heard anything about this which has made any sense whatsoever?
Well, no. And I think one of the problems we have, excuse me, is that this is directly in line with the expectations of aforementioned snobbish, metropolitan, detached liberal elite. It's going to be hugely costly. It's going to be hugely complex. And questions that require nuance, brilliant and innovative political solutions like solving the Irish border elegantly are not going to be delivered. Not under this kind of time frame, not when it comes with this kind of price tag, and frankly, not by the selection of what passes for politicians in Westminster these days, including the hapless Theresa May. This is in line with my expectations. I think 40 billion is cheap at the price. I would love for the discerning Leave voter, if indeed they exist, to explain to me what the alternative to that figure and to these kinds of conclusions looks like.
Sorry, I was just going to bring up the point that we've been talking about as well in the meeting about how Theresa May is now sort of trying to leverage the security angle at these meetings, saying, you know, they can contribute a lot of money to protecting the EU, including from Russian misinformation, and sort of trying to put that as part of a deal, perhaps, forward. I find that an interesting tactic. I read an interesting piece at the FT saying that actually what would protect most the UK and the EU would be a hard Brexit, because that would make other countries less eager to follow suit and also separate, which would be actually the most complicated thing in security-wise, because, you know, a stable and strong EU, even without Britain, is better than a lot of factioning countries. So I just find it interesting that that was one of the points leveraged, and I wonder how that's going to play out with Donald Tusk later on.
That is to say, the best possible outcome for the world as a whole is for Britain to be made an example of.
Not to be made an example of. That too, but also I think it's just,
It's the best for Brussels. You can see that because it is a disincentive, as you mentioned. But that still sort of overshadows the true point, which is ultimately the best solution for the 27 and for Britain would be to retain the status quo, which is, I think, stating the obvious.
This may be crediting, Tom, those politicians whom you just derided with more tactical acumen than they appear to be demonstrating. But is it possible that Theresa May is, you know, she campaigned for Remain, she voted Remain, she's a Remainer, a soft Remainer perhaps, but a Remainer. Is it possible that she sees the Irish question as possibly a way to, at the very least, if it's played cunningly, keep Britain in the customs union and the single market?
Well, that's an interesting point. I would probably not concur with that assertion simply on the basis that I just don't believe in May as the strategic negotiator. Even though when she first came into office...
I would like to think that if that thought's occurred to me, it's occurred to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
I wouldn't jump to conclusions. But nevertheless, it's an interesting question. And I think the Irish border is, you know, it could still be an escape, you know, the escape, the get-out-of-jail-free card. But
it's conveniently intractable, isn't it?
Well, and there's no way anybody in Brussels or in any of the other 27 capitals could possibly play a role in a set of decisions or political processes that saw the return of any kind of harder border there, which we know would facilitate friction and potentially lead to the unravelling of the Good Friday Agreement. It just cannot be allowed to happen.
Friction is the absolute most optimistic assessment of the outcome.
Well, quite, and I appreciate that's a bit of a wishy-washy term. It just that's just not going to be allowed to happen. So, to my mind, it doesn't just remain, you know, sort of a delaying tactic. It could still be a way to escape this horrible maelstrom.
Gaia, does this whole process, if that's indeed what we're witnessing, look as weird to a Brazilian expatriate in the United Kingdom as it does to an Australian one? Because just to give you a benchmark, to me, and I've lived here a long time and thought I was halfway to having some understanding of anything at all about this country, and the last couple of years have been, for me, a real education in how much, one, I don't know, and two, I suspect shall never.
I feel the same way, Andrew, and the same way that Henry said he feels somewhat disconnected from the Brexiteer. I feel somewhat disconnected from the whole process, because there's a lot of news, but in a way nothing seems to happen. It seems to be talks and negotiations, and I feel very disconnected to where this is going and if something is happening at all, if we have reached any sort of milestones in this whole process. I am not sure.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Gaia Lutz. Coming up next, will discounted rail travel turn disgruntled young folks Tory?
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Gaia Lutz and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Now, as we have just been discussing, the Conservative Party, currently more or less governing the United Kingdom, has any number of short-term problems. But it also faces a looming existential crisis, i.e. that young people don't like them. At the last general election in 2017, the Tories polled less than 25% among under-30s. That same cohort voted overwhelmingly to remain in the EU. In this week's budget, Chancellor of the Exchequer Philip Hammond has thrown this disgruntled cohort a bone, a new discount rail card for the 26 to 30s. Now, this is the millennial generation. Do we have now? I think there's some people at this table who can be accused of that. Henry, Gaia, do you qualify?
I have been given to understand that I qualify, yes, Andrew.
I think I do too.
Okay, Tom, you're slightly too old.
Andrew, I like to think I still look like I could be a millennial. However, I am not.
I'm way too old, but, you know, I bought a flat in London when they were cheap, so swings and roundabouts. Henry, speaking on behalf of your entire generation, is slightly cheaper rail travel going to turn you into a rampaging conservative?
As a 26-year-old, originally from Swansea, whose family still lives there, I am dangerously close to being a single-issue voter on cheap rail fares. Now, I'm not sure this will win me over, but I am certainly welcome the declaration that this is apparently going to go forward and will take full advantage of it.
And Gaia, speaking on behalf of your generation and the entire Southern Hemisphere, because that's your role. I mean, I can speak for the Generation X of the Southern Hemisphere, because I think that's what I technically amount to.
Possibly.
Possibly. I met Kurt Cobain once. I think that gets me that gets me in the club. Has this caused you, Gaia, to radically rethink your views of Philip Hammond?
Well, I have to say, I welcome, making trains cheaper in the UK. Every time I travel, I am shocked at how expensive they are. But I just think if you pay attention to the debate that's happening in the UK amongst the young, from housing crisis to student debt, it just seems very out of touch to offer, a rail card as a solution to entice young voters. I think that could have been offered if the youth was already on board with the current government, and then plus that's what we give you. But I think trying to persuade them with that is a little pedantic. Is that the right word, or condescending?
It's near enough, I think. Because Tom, and you can now speak on behalf of whatever the hell it is you are.
There's not a term for what Tom is, I don't think.
It's generation. I'll take that as a compliment.
It's
Henry,
generation Y, isn't it?
Why indeed, Andrew? Yeah, the question I frequently ask during these Friday night Midori House sessions.
Every sense of that phrase. Do you think, Tom, that the younger folk, and two of whom we have at this table, do have any right to be meaningfully aggrieved?
I think that they do. I do, though, take some issue with the premise that you set out in the introduction, Andrew, to this segment.
What?
Well, let me explain. Yes, it's true that basically the grizzled old Tories are and will continue to die out. However, I think there's a strange process that happens, and you only need to venture out.
You're trying to tell us something about yourself,
well,
Tom.
No, venture out
into
the countryside.
Are you going through this metamorphosis?
And there are certainly no shortage of, how to describe, braying, gilet-wearing idiots who you can see are well on the way on their own personal transition to fully-fledged Tory middle-agehood. And strangely, I think that process is age-related. I think as people eke their way into their 40s and 50s, we know you become essentially more reactionary and probably more sort of self-centred, which is, one might say, the preserve of the Tories in a meaningful way.
Have you got any ideas about national service you want to share with us, Tom?
I must say I do think it's an excellent good idea. So I do think that there will be a replacement. But nevertheless, I think the Tories' key demographic, sort of white-haired colonels and such, there's no question that they need to recalibrate their approach. But I certainly agree with my two youthful colleagues that the idea of, throwing somebody the bone of a bit of free, reduced travel is, frankly, I agree with Gaia, it's almost insulting.
And it's also ignoring the point that, the main problem is that someone at 30 shouldn't have to, get discount rail. They should be able to afford traveling.
It's a tacit recognition of having to give a rail card to someone who's 30, that you are not driving an economy that supports somebody who's contributed to the economy, can buy a place of their own, and can afford to travel around. We shouldn't need to do this. It's almost a recognition of their own failures.
It is exactly that. But just a final thought on this one, Henry, because the most common complaint, and it's a perfectly reasonable one, all things considered, from the people we're going to describe as millennials, is that the price of housing has just become preposterous. But is this also perhaps the government admitting that really there's not an awful lot they can actually do about that?
Oh, totally. Well, in the sense that it's a fig leaf that they're holding up to kind of shield this glaring truth, which is that no matter how much you travel, even if you live in Swansea or further away, there are a few places that are further away, but even if you live somewhere like that, the amount of money that you're going to save having a third off rail tickets every year is not going to make a significant difference to your life outcomes, is it? So, it's pleasant, but it is not as substantial as it's being made to seem, I think.
There's one thing I would say on a sort of apolitical note here, which is there's been some good books and good pieces written about how the boomer generation themselves are not without responsibility here. And that is rather apolitical. I think there's no question that the post-war boomer generation rode this sort of wave of home ownership. They leveraged, they re-leveraged, they leveraged again. They poured the money back into more property, into their own businesses. And they pretty much kicked the ladder away. And I don't think that is an exclusively Tory demographic who exhibited those behaviours.
No, indeed not.
Or showed an enthusiasm for it. In fact, you only have to go around a number of London boroughs, including the likes of Islington, Upper Holloway, where Jeremy Corbyn himself is the representative, to see plenty of kind of old school socialists, pretty left wing people who are, can I say controversially, pretty happy that their townhouse bought when they were teachers or whatever in the early 70s, they sell them for 3-4 million quid and then go and buy more land out in the sticks. And that is a generational problem. And if I was a millennial, I would of course rail against the Tories, but I would also rail against maybe
a generation
who possibly made the kind of journey that they went on more difficult for me to make.
Well, finally tonight, we have here, and I hope you've all brought your handouts with you, some pictures of these are diagrams, if you will, of a Brazilian prison. Gaia, what are we looking at here?
Okay, so we're looking at the prison of Benfica in Rio de Janeiro, and why this has been on the news very much so recently in Brazil, is that this is the first time that three governors, all of Rio, are arrested at once in the same prison. That is not to count the other, chairman of the legislative assembly and ex-military police, all other sorts of politicians. But there are three governors of Rio in the same police, in the same prison right now.
This is great. It's like Queensland in the early 1980s. these are pictures from Globo, the Brazilian newspaper. But it's a very helpful diagram explaining who's staying in which cell and who's next door to whom.
Exactly. It's become a sort of reality show thing. I was, doing the papers.
I was just thinking that the sitcom writes itself. Somebody must be working on this.
No, it is. Even the rhetoric and the language has been changing. I was doing the papers today with Henry on the 10. And, just the language was sort of like, find out who's next to who in the prison. It just seemed a little bit funny,
Well, except with the twist that you could have a public vote about who's next to go in.
It's very strange, but they are doing the thing where they're keeping, so now, for example, there are two governors. One was arrested last Wednesday. The other one's been for a year. And these are from very publicly known parties to hate each other and very, public enemies, let's say. And so they're being kept at different cells. But in one cell, for instance, there's the governor and all, his secretary and, all the people that worked with him. And so, his wife is upset.
So hang on a second. They're keeping the people from rival parties separate.
It's like the Crips and Bloods.
Yes. Yeah, but where's the fun in that? I mean, everyone knows if you're laying out the table arrangements for, a wedding or some other function, you totally stack these things to increase the chances of a punch-up, like we always do at the Monocle Christmas
there
party.
There is that, because from 8 to 1800, they all the prisoners go to have their sunbathing in a sort of shared common space. So they'll meet there and they'll have plenty to talk about, I can imagine.
That's Norwellian euphemism if I've ever heard one. Sunbathing in a Brazilian prison.
Two things immediately jumped out at me looking at these graphics, which I did enjoy very much. One was exactly what Guy just mentioned, which is the little sort of solarium area. Very agreeable, for sure. The second one was, I just thought, purely, there's a lot of pressure on the public finances in Rio State and, across the whole of the country of Brazil, sadly. Would they not have saved a great deal of money instead of incarcerating all these people in a prison, simply turning the Legislative Assembly itself into a prison building? Having everyone go about their business, but maybe a ring of steel around the outside, Bob's your uncle, and they'd save a great deal of money.
It has struck me, Gaia, several times while reporting on this story or talking to our correspondents in Brazil as we've watched this story unfold, whether it is it actually literally yet at the point where it is quicker to list the Brazilian politicians who aren't on the hook for something or other?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this story comes off the back of a very interesting fact that since redemocratization in Brazil, we had nine governors to Rio. Three of them are arrested now. Three of them are investigated. Two are dead. And so that leaves us one guy that no one has said anything yet about him. And back to your point, Tom, about, a more economic way of sort of doing this incarceration. It's interesting because they actually built this jail for the car wash operation culprits. So this is a new, brand new jail just for these new people coming in.
This is truly beyond satire.
Well, it actually is. I know we've been sitting here trying to think of funny things to say about it, but that's basically where we come down to, that Brazil has literally built an entire prison just to accommodate its bent politicians. I do commend the graphic to our listeners, however. It's on Globo's website. It's extremely helpful. And, it's just one of those things that you don't really even know what to say, because it just... And on that coherent and articulate note, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Tom Edwards, Gaia Lutz, Henry Rhys Sheridan, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Jolene Goffin, researched by Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.